It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Yeah, and Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here from freedomsphoenix.com studios. Freedoms with an S, phoenix.com. And in Phoenix, Arizona, very nice day today. It always is. You know, it's like 365 days, it's 360-something without clouds. That's how it is. Now, today we're going to be talking about a subject that may be scary to some of the RBN audience. I want to make sure that you guys understand we're going to go a full hour with someone that knows what we're going to be talking about here, and that is anarchy in the USA. Anarchy. Now, there's a comment from this segment's really short. You know, I got Lou on the line. We're going to go ahead, and I'm going to preface the topic today. We're going to take a short break. We'll come right back. It's only like a four-minute segment here, and we just once we get in deep into it, we go. But I want to preface it with this. A common friend of ours and one of the contributors to both Freedom's Phoenix and to LouRockwell.com is a guy named Butler Schaefer. He's a law professor in Southern California. And, you know, he has made a good case here. I'm just going to take a couple of lines to kind of frame our argument or our discussion today. The word anarchy invokes unfocused fear of uncertain forces. Images of bomb-throwing thugs who smash and burn property of others are routinely conjured up by politicians and the media to frighten people into an extension of police authority over their lives. But to condemn a philosophic viewpoint because a few wish to corrupt its meaning for their narrow advantage is no more justifiable than condemning Christianity because a man murders his family and defends his acts on the grounds that God told me to do it. Now, Butler Schaefer goes on then to quote Robert Lefebvre, another, you know, freedom advocate, you know, another generation that had a big impact on a lot of people. He defined an anarchist as someone who believes in less government than you do. But Butler goes on to explain, but an even better understanding of the concept can be derived from the Greek origins of the word anarchos, which meant without a ruler. It is this definition of the word that members of the political power structure, i.e. your rulers, do not want you to consider. Now, what happened, I went, and that was written back in January of 2004. And I'm sure he holds the same position. Now, there was another article online that was done by a liberal. It's called Liberal Post. Now, the Liberal Post interviewed Lou Rockwell because Lou Rockwell, you know, he'll tell us here in a minute. Lou, tell me, how many hits a month do you get on LouRockwell.com?
Well, we have about almost 7 million visitors a year. So, 7 million visitors a month.
A lot.
So it's a lot. Yeah, hits is sort of a, you know, we have many more hits than that, but you get...
Well, you got 7 million people that are exposed to your...
Visits a month.
A lot of people. You are influential in the freedom movement. Now, you were asked by this Liberal Post guy, this was done in May of 07, so we're talking a couple of years ago. Some say you're an anarchist. Is that true? And you answer, the term anarchist is mostly used to mean someone who believes that the state and law are gotten rid of and all property would then become collectively owned. You know, and you're saying, nah, that's not but, you know, that's not really the definition. Now, when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Lou Rockwell, we're going to get his definition of what anarchism is and how it's coming. You know, anarchy coming soon. Get used to it. You need to understand what's coming. And we'll talk about here and Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and Lou Rockwell in just a little bit.
There are those that just want to be left alone.
and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Yeah, we're back here in Phoenix, Arizona on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and you don't even need a government form. And we got Lou Rockwell on the other side. Lou Rockwell, you the man. And I want to make sure that this audience, as we have a new audience here, the new show, and they're starting to understand that we're a little bit different. But we need to have the same terminology. We need to understand definition of the words that we're using. When we talk about anarcho-capitalist or anarchy in the USA, when somebody asks you to say, are you an anarchist, you first say what, and then how do you explain it? Lou?
And before I go into a little bit of the background, I always like Stephen Kinsella's definition, and he's got a great article on LouRockwell.com about this. But really what it means, here's what it means to be an anarchist, that you think that it is never right to use violence or the threat of violence against the innocent. That's what it means to be an anarchist. It doesn't mean that you think anarchism might ever be possible. It doesn't mean you necessarily know how everything would function in an anarchist society. It simply means that you think it's wrong to use violence or the threat of violence against the innocent. Now, when I say that, virtually everybody's going to say, well, gee, I don't think it's right either. But, of course, you do think it's right if you believe in taxation under any circumstances, if you believe in the initiation of force against people under any circumstances. What the government is, and if I can put it in a nutshell, that government is that institution that thinks that if you don't pay its parking ticket and sufficiently resist paying its parking ticket, they have the right to shoot you.
Oh, you say no to the government.
That's the government. So there's no, I believe in governance. I mean, we need governance in the family and the community and the corporation and the church and so forth. That's all legitimate. But the state, I mean, that institution that thinks that it has, that it's above the law, and that's what the government thinks it is, it thinks the law doesn't apply to it. It's above the law, it makes the law, it applies the law to you. Well, I would say nobody should be above the law. The things that are wrong for you and me, Ernie, to steal, to kill, and so forth, that's wrong for the government. It doesn't matter, a guy's in a government suit and he's saying, well, they're terrorists, therefore we can shoot at all these people in Afghanistan. That's murder. So that's wrong for the government, it's wrong for us.
You know, the one thing that I want to make sure we get on this, Lou, I want to make sure I get this in. When you say no to the government enough, there's guns involved. I mean, no matter what it is.
If you don't want to pay your taxes, if you don't want to be drafted by them, kidnapped, as we call it in the private society, if you don't want to be looted by them, taxation is what they call it, if you don't want to have them seize your property, eminent domain, or you didn't allegedly pay your taxes, or you really didn't pay your property taxes.
Or you don't pay a parking ticket.
Or you don't pay a parking ticket, you are not going to pay it, and you have guns in your house, and you say, look, if you people come in here, break into my house with guns, I'm going to defend myself, then they feel they can shoot you and kill you like a dog. So that's the government. So, yes, I reject that. Now, as to the word anarchy, as you know, of course, anarchy it was illegal at one time in this country in the 20s to be an anarchist. Was a grounds against having you ever visit this country if you were an anarchist. And there indeed is a strain of people who call themselves anarchists who, as you said, they don't believe in private property. They believe in the initiation of violence and bomb throwing and so forth. So that gave a bad name. It's also possible to call anarchy a private property order, because if you read the great anarchist philosopher ever, Murray and Rothbard, who you and I both had the great honor of knowing, and what a great writer. I mean, just look at the Rothbard archives on LouRockwell.com or on Mises.org. All his books and articles are there for you to read for free. It's also great to buy them and to own them. So this is the man who showed us that the correct view of anarchy has to be based on private property, that everything's based on private property, the private property in yourself and in the things that you acquire legitimately. Not by taxation, not by the government giving it to you, but through voluntary means. Either you pay for it, it's given to you as a gift, or you inherit it. Those are the three ways to own property legitimately. Any other way is just theft. And it doesn't matter that they've got a government badge on or they got a government suit on. They're engaged in theft. The government lives off theft. Murray Rothbard said government is a gang of thieves writ large.
They're a gang with a flag.
So, yeah, they have that little flag, and we're supposed to bow down to them. That's the military banner of the state. I remember there was an Irish defender of Irish independence who referred to the Union Jack, the British flag, the flag of the British Empire, as being the butcher's apron. Well, maybe in some... You know,
wow, that's a good...
I mean, it's a great... This was a 19th century... But
wow,
anyway,
there's a difference.
These are military flags, right? The American flag is a military flag. And we all feel a certain pull because we're taught this in the schools, in the government schools. Although I must say I was blessed, I never attended a government school, but most of us are forced into the government schools. And we're certainly all forced to pay for the government schools, where these are systems of indoctrination, where the government seeks to stamp out any thought of such things as anarchy, stamp out individualism, stamp out independent thinking,
stamp out
critical thinking, and make you into a kid happy to go be drafted to murder people in Iran, or happy to give the tax police your money, happy to bow down to the mayor, to the governor, to the president, whatever is the government official who feels they own you, and they can apply the law to you. They are above the law. All the things that are illegal for you are okay for them. I remember when Bush started the second Iraq war, which has led to the death of more than a million people. A million people. Of course, no American cares about them. They're gooks, right? They should care about them because they are people and they have their rights too. But I remember when Bush started this Iraq war, this war of aggression. This was the first crime charged against the Nazis, the Nuremberg trial, by the way. Fomenting wars of aggression. This is a crime against humanity. So when Bush was starting his last crime against humanity, which President Obama, of course, is continuing, he has blood on his hands, too. What I remember when Bush started it, he had from the brilliant American intelligence the news that Saddam Hussein and his sons were eating in a restaurant in Baghdad. So they started off things by dropping a 5,000-pound, or I don't remember what the weight was, some huge bomb on this restaurant. Turned out Saddam and his sons weren't in there. So the owner, the chef, the waiters, the customers, they were all killed. You know, if one of us bombed a restaurant, we'd rightly be called a murderer. You know what? George Bush murdered those people. He is a murderer. Obama's a murderer. Truman was a murderer. Roosevelt was a murderer. Some of these guys, Lincoln, of course, were vast murderers. Some of them, American presidents, smaller murderers. But this is taking the red pill. This is, if you remember the movie The Matrix. Once you understand that the law applies, the moral law applies to everybody, and just because somebody's voted into office, just because somebody has got a different suit on, does not mean that the moral law does not apply to them.
Okay, now
this is taking the red pill. You see everything differently. And they don't want you to see this.
No, this is what I want to get into.
And all of a sudden you realize Obama's just like the next-door neighbor. And if your next-door neighbor can't do things to you, can't take your property, can't force you to shoot people, can't force you into a socialized medical plan or whatever, then neither can this bird in Washington do that.
Okay, now this is the one thing I want to get to. I want you to finish your thought, but I want to focus on this one point. This point is what I want to talk about. When Rothbard goes on and he's saying the natural state of humanity as we evolve, as we progress, is that, anarcho-capitalism, of course you're going to have capitalism, you know, because it's mine. I got my stuff. And how do you are able to have your stuff is the only way is that you're able to defend your stuff. And then you have these governments will come in and say, you know, hey, we'll do that job. You grant us authority and we will protect and we'll go to the county recorder and we'll mark it down and we'll survey it out and we'll say, okay, this is your stuff. And we'll use these government gendarmes. We'll go out and have the long arm of the law is going to protect you against other people trying to take your stuff. Except for us. We can take your stuff, okay? So that's where Rothbard was kind of talking. I wanted to get you to go on about this one thing. If you had no government, would you be able to keep your stuff? If you have a government, are you able to keep your stuff? So I just, you know, it's kind of a George Carlin thing, man. I got my stuff. You know, I'm going to go out, and the only way I can keep my stuff is if I can protect my stuff, if I have title to my stuff. How is that done without a government?
Of course, this is the great argument for the government. I find it a fundamentally stupid argument, but, I mean, this is a very persuasive argument to people, especially when they're taught in the government schools, and they're taught by churches, and they're taught by churchmen, I should say, and they're taught by school teachers and newspaper people and television people and all that sort of thing. What Thomas Hobbes said many years ago, the British, evil British philosopher, that in a state of nature, life is nasty, brutish, and short, because everybody's killing everybody else, as Horace said that man is a wolf to other men. And this is Horace, a magnificent poet, but a paid propagandist for the Roman state and the Emperor Augustus. So man is not a wolf to each other. Yes, some people are. Of course, there are bad people. There are evil people in the world. There are murderers. There are rapists. There are thieves. And they don't all work for the government. I don't want to shock you. Sometimes there are private people who do this stuff. So, yes, you have to be concerned about that. You have to have policing agencies. You have to have protective agencies. The government is the one group that says, we're going to protect you from theft by stealing some of your stuff. We're going to protect you from the murderers by committing a lot of murders. I don't find that a persuasive argument, but yeah, that's the great justification for government. All I can say to people is, don't buy it.
Don't buy it. We're going to a break here. Lou will be right back with Lou Rockwell here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, from the fabulous FreedomsPhoenix.com studios. We'll be right back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Jet he's so excited, he wants to talk to Lou Rockwell. And I said, make sure you get your microphone all set. And he missed a cue on the music. Now, the one thing that we want to do here is we want to make sure that we get an understanding of anarchy. Now, Jet has formulated a really good question that I want to get into this, because, you know, you turn Lou on, man, he's got plenty to say. So go ahead and get ready, Lou. Here, Jet, go ahead and ask your question.
Good morning, Lou.
Morning.
I have a question about, I'm reading Mr. Rothbard's Anatomy of the State right now.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
He makes some very poignant observations regarding the judiciary and their real role as an agent of the state as opposed to their stated role as an independent arbiter. He states that their main role is to create legitimacy for the state's actions, and through judicial review, an unconstitutional verdict is a powerful check on the government, but a constitutional verdict is a mighty weapon for fostering public acceptance or of even greater government power. What, in your estimation, is the solution to this problem?
Well, you know, first of all, it's absolutely true that in history, the state has grown and empowered itself through the judicial function, because we all understand that there are disputes in society that need to be resolved. And there have been private courts. There are private courts in existence. But if we take the example of England, the King of England set out to provide what he said was the superior justice, the king's justice, and he sought to suppress and take control of all other local courts and to bring everything into the national system. And it was a powerful propaganda thing for the government. But we can only think about in our own country, think of the American judicial system. I mean, does anybody really think that you go to the local federal judge to get justice? I mean, you're pulled before him, you're forced before him. This is not the source of justice. But you absolutely do need justice. Justice, which in medieval terms was defined as suum quique, to each his own, that is, that each of us has what is properly ours. And if anybody takes what's properly ours, then of course there's, you know, restitution, punishment. Private Germanic courts are very interesting. I mean, there've all been all kinds of private court systems in history, but it's absolutely true. And just think of our own country. The courts are frightening institutions that you don't feel like you're going to get justice. On the other hand, I think we probably all know in our own lives, and I've certainly been blessed to know in my life, men and women who you felt could be an independent source of justice, that people would go to in a private situation and say, we've got this dispute, we trust you, we'd like to pay you to look at all the facts and tell us and make a judgment. We agree to abide by what you say. The American Arbitration Association works this way. The state hates this, of course. They'd like to destroy all private justice, remaining private justice, bring it all into the so-called public system. It's not really public. I mean, the state is in a sense of a bunch of bad private people using the propaganda public to rip off the rest of us. They're parasites. The government has got nothing. Remember this when they're talking about health care. The government has nothing of its own. It only has what it grabs from the rest of us by force. They put a gun to your head, and they say, do as we say or we're going to kill you. Pay up or we're going to kill you. If it's the mafia, we realize there's something funny about that. When it's the government, we're taught to believe, gee, it's a great thing. So the justice system, the so-called criminal justice system, is indeed criminal. Once in a while, justice is provided, but mostly this is all state empowerment stuff, and you can see through the courts. Hans Hermann Hoppe, another great Hoppe, another great anarchist theorist. You can look him up on LouRockwell.com, and also Butler Schaefer, as Ernie mentioned earlier. Look at all his magnificent archive in LouRockwell.com. You can buy his books at Mises.org. Look at Hoppe's archive on LouRockwell.com. You can get his books. Also get, I must say, Butler's books there. Many great libertarian thinkers. Take a look at, for example, the anarcho-capitalist bibliography that's on LouRockwell.com that Professor Hoppe did. Many, many great, but Hans is especially great on this whole justice question and how it's Hans's view. There's a great libertarian philosopher. His book is still very much worth reading, a man called Franz Oppenheimer, who wrote at the beginning of the 20th century, and he wrote a great book called The State. And it was his view that, you know, he said there are two ways, I'm simplifying what is a magnificent and eloquent book, and he talks about historical questions and political questions, economic questions, and he says there are two ways to acquire property, one you can earn it and one you can seize it. And the state, he said, is the organization. And he said one is the economic means and one is the political means. And the state is the organization of the political means, that is, of the seizure of property. And, of course, we're all to be convinced this is not theft, that it's justice for these birds to grab some of your property and use it for their own purposes. And you're a bad person if you don't want to go along with that. So Hans, however, thinks that the state originated, and, of course, we're talking about the distant mists of history here, but he feels the state originated through the question of justice, that the people who one normally went to in society for justice, for when I talked about the private people, these would be noblemen or whatever in those days, that sometimes these people, unfortunately, use this position to seize power and to be the monopoly justice provider. And so you couldn't go to anybody else. We are the monopoly. And by the way, we'll also decide how much you're going to pay us.
You know, that's one thing that...
Like all monopolies, they want more and more money and do less and less work. That's the story of the government.
I understand, and when we get back, we're going to get to that, because it's all about eliminating competition. It's, you know, you're not allowed to supply the needs of the people. We're going to talk about more when we come back on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Lou Rockwell in just a little bit.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Independence, me, Ernest Hancock, and as always, one of my favorite peoples, Lou Rockwell. You go to LouRockwell.com, that's LouRockwell.com. Lots of good stuff, and I just tell you, Lou, thanks, man, we rip you off a lot, you know that, right?
Hey, please do it.
And, you know, sometimes you have such a good day that I just go, how the heck, I'm not going to enter every single one of these. I just take your whole page and put it up in the article and say, here, you go click to it yourself. You know,
well,
he had a great day. So the one thing that I did want to get into, and Jet was really adamant about me asking for solutions rather than just more books to read, which he's doing. But, you know, I mean, there's a few things you can do. You can advocate for a clean definition, you know, of what the proper role of government is and whether, you know, Can I choose not to have a ruler? I mean, is that even an option? You know, I wish to not have a ruler. And the other one is, like, can you advocate for no force or fraud from government? You hold them up to a standard. And then eventually it gets down to you have to actually physically resist. There has to be some kind of action. There has to be a resistance, because these big bad guys that are used to just going around with their shiny badge and a clipboard with a little embossed sealed on the parchment and in their uniform and their fine hat, and there's always an available gun somewhere, and they show up and they say, oh, by the way, your children belong to the man, go fight somewhere. There's a point at which you have to go, no. And when does that happen? How are some creative ways that we can do that? And how do you advocate that this generation next resist the tyranny that's being demanded of them?
Well, you know, Ernie, I want to say I'm practically a pacifist, and for reasons of Christian reasons, I actually do not advocate force resistance by force of these people. But I'll talk about that again in a second. Let me mention what the great anarchist Albert J. Nock, and by the way, his book, I hate to recommend a book to read, Our Enemy, the State, which you can get from Mises.org, and look at Nock's, the Nock articles I've got on LouRockwell.com. What an eloquent and unbelievably great writer, and what an astounding man he was. But Nock was once asked, you know, some of these questions, and he said, this is a very tough thing, this is a tough saying. What he said was, you know, the most you can do for society is present it with one improved unit. Now, that's maybe I don't take exactly that position, but, you know, actually the first thing you need to do if you're interested and if you'd like to try to persuade is learn stuff yourself. Read books. There is no 12-step plan to overthrowing the state. I wish I had such a thing. I wish I knew of such a thing. There is no such thing. So the first thing you need to do is fill yourself with knowledge. Learn some economics, learn some Austrian economics, learn some history, learn some anarchist theory, read books, read Butler Schaefer, read Murray Rothbard, read Hans Hermann Hoppe, read Franz Oppenheimer, read these people and learn, and when you yourself start to know these things, others will come to you, others will take your advice, others will be influenced by you, but it's not a matter of grabbing other people by the lapel and saying, hey, you know, this and so. It's you have to
declare your independence.
Well, you know, listen to the fantastic Bob Lefebvre lectures. What a great teacher he was. That are all up on Mises.org for free. Listen to this guy. Listen, read, improve yourself. That is the really maybe it's the only thing you can do. Certainly, it's the first thing you can do. And the key thing is, and I read Murray Rothbard on Étienne de la Boétie. This is a Boetie. He was a Frenchman in the 16th century, and he wrote a great essay on the state and about the politics of obedience and the mystery of obedience. He said, "Why is it that people?" He said, "You know, if you listen," I'm paraphrasing a very great essay in the history of libertarianism and of anarchism, but he said, "You know that." If you listen to the king and his minions, you know, they're always worried about why is it that some people disobey? How do we deal with those people, those horrible people? But he said the actual interesting question to me is why the heck does anybody obey? Why do people obey these guys? You know, when they say, I want your money, I want your child from my army, I want whatever else they want. Why do we obey? And, you know, that they all depend on our obedience. This is what David Hume and Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard and de la Boetie and all so many other great thinkers have talked about. They depend on our obedience, because a parasite to live and be happy has to be a minority. The people who live off the rest of us are a minority, and they depend on our consent. So when we withdraw our consent, they become powerless. Now, that sounds like a sort of a science fiction thing, but I'll argue that we're actually seeing a little bit of this happening right now.
Yes.
With the Obama healthcare plan. People are withdrawing their consent from this further advance in the fascist, socialized, whatever it is, the American.
Oh, even larger. It goes more than
medical,
that. It goes more than that.
The
people are withdrawing their consent on it. They're starting to look at, you know, Obama comes up. He ran on this. We're going to have single payer, nationalized health care. The government loves you. Okay. And we're going to take care of you. pinky swear. And when they do this, they're looking at it with a much more critical eye this time because they've learned that the government is bad. So, you know, when is the time that we start to withdraw our consent even between our ears? And that's one thing, as you read some of the revolutionary colonial time writings of the time, they were like, look, the revolution was going on way before the shot was heard. That was just a manifestation of what people had come to feel, to know, to live, to understand. You know, this is common sense comes out and kind of puts it in a box. And then the last couple of years, we had this revolution going on of this younger generation that people, and I'm sure you yourself, a lot of people were worried that how in the heck are we ever going to reach this next generation? They have been indoctrinated by the mandatory youth indoctrination camps with their camp leaders getting up there BSing them, and all of a sudden, from out of the blue, in support of a 72-3-year-old man from Texas, it just came this revolution. And where did it come from? Where is this understanding? Was there always a need? Was it something suppressed? And you were right in the middle of this thing. Tell me, why do you think it was that they came out of the woodwork? What brought that on?
Well, I think it was the circumstances of the situation we're in. People worried about their economic future, wondering what the heck has happened. But of course, it was the great leadership and example of Ron Paul. And it was the ideas, as he would be the first to say, of so many great men and women writing over so many decades, so many generations, writing about liberty, writing about property, writing about all the ideas that we're talking about today. Mises and Rothbard, Henry Hazlitt, we're talking about economics and, say, the Fed, which is something that's very much in the news these days, thanks to the Ron Paul movement and thanks to Ron Paul, thanks to his 30 years of work, but thanks to many great books, many great teachers, huge work by so many, sometimes heralded, sometimes unheralded, so many great people of liberty over so many generations, Bob LaFave and Butler Schaefer, all these great men and women, Ayn Rand and Isabel Patterson and Rose Wilder Lane, and oh gosh, just the there's so many people in our Hall of Fame, so many great people who just spent their lives talking about this.
But you never hear
this
on CBS.
It.
You're not going to get it on
well,
network.
Well, that's the government.
News.
That's the government network, right? I mean, these are all government networks.
Now, the one thing I want to get from you in this mindset right now is that, you know, Dr. Paul's out there. It went from in the Fed to audit the Fed. I guess it's kind of a step in, you know, towards that.
Well, you know, his new book that comes out this month is called End the Fed.
Yay, because I
this
don't
is
remember
what
people,
he talks about.
I don't remember people screaming audit the Fed.
Now, well, this is a way of putting a little, lighting a little fire under their feet, and it's a way of giving them trouble.
I understand, but I want to get your
mindset. Of course,
mindset.
We need to talk about the Federal Reserve, the counterfeiting operation.
Well, Lou, I want to get this. I want to get to this one point right here. I know you got a lot to say, but this one focus right here. You have, and you were associated with Dr. Paul. You used to be in his congressional office.
I had the great honor of working and being associated with Dr. Ron Paul, yes.
So this is, I mean, you know Dr. Paul. So this is, you know, so right now we have an admitted anarchist, Lou Rockwell, going anarchy in the USA, and at the same time you have Dr. Paul and his, because I remember when this revolution thing first started, the first question I had about our involvement in this is that would it be a net positive if you're out there advocating for someone running for president of this very thing that is so damaging to freedom? You know, are you advocating? Are you bringing people deeper into the mind fog? Are you where's the light? What is it that you're advocating? So in your role in this, and LouRockwell.com and what the writers that you put up and the articles that you find important that you should share and the things that you have to say, being so closely associated with this revolution and Dr. Paul, where is the line? At what point do you go, man, just political participation is just bad? You know, so, I mean, is there a line? Are you using it in some way? Are you understanding my question?
Yeah, well, I'm an anarchist, and Ron Paul's a constitutionalist, but he's very happy to have anarchists as part of his movement. As he said, freedom brings us all together, and we can all, you know, the Gene Burns, who was a libertarian at once upon a time, used to give a wonderful speech, and he talked about the freedom train, and he said, get on this freedom train, and maybe you won't go all the way to the last station. Maybe you get off at a interim station, but we're all welcome. We're all welcome on Ron Paul's freedom train. And that's true of constitutionalists, that's true of anarchists, that's true of conservatives, that's true of liberals. Everybody is welcome who wants, who's concerned about their freedom, concerned about too much government. We are all brought together by the cause of freedom. So read Ron Paul's book when it comes out. It's a great book. It's called End the Fed, and he talks about why the central bank is a morally evil institution, why it's an economically disastrous institution, why it's a politically disastrous institution, why it must be ended. This is the position he takes. But, you know, and so, and I must say, from a standpoint of politics, I certainly don't advocate anybody vote for anybody. I've never asked anybody to vote for anybody. I don't vote myself. I think it's, but for those who want to do it, you know, I certainly have no problem with people who want to vote for Ron Paul.
I vote every time I put a sign up. A
more power to them, right? God bless them. I, you know, so this is a big tent. We can all be together. We don't have to all agree on every single thing.
You know,
and,
the thing
I, I can agree that if you were to, I happen to think the Constitution was a, you know, and of course I'm not speaking for Ron Paul in anything here, right? I mean, I'm not, I'm only speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for the Mises Institute. I'm only speaking for myself. Maybe I'm speaking for my own website, lourockwell.com, but not for anybody else. So, I, you know, I think I hate electoral politics. I think it's by and large corrupt and corrupting. And I think that the fact that over 200 years in American politics, we got one good guy in 200 years should be a clue that there's something wrong with this system.
Who is that? People, Jefferson?
No, Ron Paul.
Oh, I'm talking. Thought you were
That's
talking
the
about
only
president.
Guy. No.
Yeah,
Thomas Jefferson.
He had his
Thomas
own problems.
Jefferson
I know.
Was a great guy before and after he was in politics. He was a bad guy in politics.
Yeah, he had his
so,
own problems.
Look, there's never in 200 years of politics there's one guy. So again, I think that tells you. And Ron Paul uses his political office not to get contracts for the people in his district or all that baloney. He uses it as a pulpit. He's always used it as a pulpit. He's always used it as a platform to teach the ideas of freedom, and God bless him, and he's a great man, and one of the great men of American history, and maybe we'll look back on him as the greatest man ever to be in politics in America.
Oh,
I think
it's the biggest
movement
in our lifetime.
I think that's it. I don't think
it's
anybody, nobody to compare with Ron Paul in all the history of American politics, in all the history of electoral politics in all the world. I don't care about whether you're talking about, you know, Gladstone or... There were great guys in the English Parliament and great guys in other parliaments. But you know what? There's never been anybody like Ron Paul. Never anybody like him. But I don't think that Ron. I must say, and you know, this is, you know, I'm definitely not speaking for Ron when I say this. I don't think that Ron Paul is a reason to get involved to run yourself or whatever. It's a, you know, people who go into politics and shows that we've got free will. We don't have to become bad people. In politics, Ron Paul shows that it's actually possible. But you know what? There's something about running to have power over others that's corrupting. There's something about having power over others that's corrupting. I don't care whether you're the town councilman or the mayor or whatever, and you're the in a little tiny town. These are corrupting positions, and maybe there are good people who go into them. There's a reason they all become bad. There's something corrupting about politics.
Well, a lot of times it's also somebody
that
has a character. They have the character, like you're saying, to even run. The person that would seek that position, and they talked about
this. There's something wrong about it.
They have a low self. That's one thing I found when I'm dealing with any kind of politics. When I first started becoming an activist, you know, and there's economic reasons. And
they all had bad... upbringing.
They
all have bad
wrong
something wrong
them.
In their upbringing. Look at all of them, Gingrich and all of them, Obama. There's something, you know, it
character
maybe,
flaw.
Maybe
they were low in self esteem. They were
Ron
low
Paul.
In self esteem. Dr. Paul does not have a low self esteem.
No. And if you look at Ron Paul's upbringing, and people are not responsible for the fact that their father was a knife murderer, whatever. But still, that has an effect on you when you have a bad upbringing. Ron Paul's upbringing was a good upbringing. He was brought up on a farm. His father was a great man. I knew his father and his mother. They were great people. His brothers and sisters are great people. He grew up in a normal home. He had that blessing. And, yes, that helped form him and shape him. But the typical person in politics comes from a very warped background. Again, that's not their fault. But what is their fault is they seek power over others. They seek to run your life. You know, the decent person doesn't want to run the next door neighbor's life. You got enough trouble running your own life.
Yeah, a lot
but there
of
are
people...
people who want to run the next door neighbor. They want to run the town next door. They want to run the country next door. They think they're perfectly justified in murdering people in the country next door. They think they're perfectly justified in murdering you if you don't want to go along.
And they want to have these kind of politicians. These people,
you know,
they want
Ron
to get them
so
in
sweet.
Their stable. They have
Ron
a stable
is,
you know, of congressmen. They'll go in. Not only do you have people that are seeking these positions, you have people that look for people that are like that, that they can control. In fact, you have armies of them. It's called Congress.
You know what? I work for Ron Paul. I know what kind of a man he is. I've watched him and followed him since I first met him in the middle 1970s. So I know what kind of a good man he is. And he always thinks the best of other people, and he always, you know, he never talks about other people's motives, and he thinks that he looks even to the best in, you know, Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich and all these people, and he's very sweet, he's such a good person, a much better person than I am. But I tend to look, you know, I tend to think these are all criminals. And I think that maybe they weren't criminals earlier in their life. Maybe Nancy Pelosi didn't start out to be a criminal. I don't know. But she is a criminal, far worse than a mafia boss. At least the mafia maybe provides services people want to have. Nancy Pelosi forces things on you. She's a monster. And do we want more monsterism in our lives? Do we want more monsterism in our country? Or do we want something different?
Let's advocate for something different here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Lou Rockwell from lewrockwell.com, lewrockwell.com. We'll be right back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Anarchy in the USA. Are we advocating that? Yeah, probably. I mean, you know, somebody asked me, they always go to me, Lou, and they'll say, well, you're just an anarchist. And I'm like, compared to what? To what we got now? Heck, man, I raise my hand up high. You know, it's so bad. And it's not just because the government's so bad. It's our understanding of it is so poor. And, you know, you do a great job in trying to make sure that the people have the information to start understanding what the proper role is. But it's more than that. It is an inevitability that we are going to descend into an anarchy. Now, they would think that that'd be bad or something, but it gets to the point to where the government is so ill-respected, that is so outside of any kind of justification for their existence of any benefit to humanity, that people just, if you ignore it, it'll go away. But they're not going to do that voluntarily. They're going to start getting nasty. They're going to pay attention to us, respect my authority. So where do you think this is going and how fast?
Well, I think that there's trouble for the state. You know, that because, you know, they are very aware, and maybe I'll even tell a story about that. I can't tell who told me this story, but they are very aware of popular opinion. They are constantly polling. They are very concerned about what people think about things. And they know, you know, they feel themselves, I wish this were the case, by the way, they feel themselves to be, if I can put it in these terms, fleas on a dog. And they're always concerned about the dog scratching them off. Now, the dog actually, we're the dog, and we actually are capable of scratching off those fleas. But I'm afraid that most people aren't aware of that because of the vast propaganda we're subjected to from the schools, from church people, from the government itself, of course, from the universities, from all the intellectuals, constantly telling us just how necessary those fleas are to our existence. And, of course, rather than being a few fleas, there's a huge tribe of fleas on the dog. And they're very happy to be there. We ought to scratch them off. And I think that as you know, the economic crisis, like any crisis, can bring about radical change. I think people are much more open to things like understanding the Fed. I must say, I've been interested in the Fed all my life since I was a little boy, and I've never found anybody, regular people, interested in it. It's a MIGO issue in the past. Made your eyes glaze over. I tried to explain, and I certainly had no effect, unlike Ron Paul, that it's a very interesting issue. They're ripping you off. They're ripping you off. This is the institution that makes possible global wars. We're like World War 1 and World War II, makes possible the vast growth of the welfare state, makes possible all the horrors of the 20th century, couldn't have happened without central banks, because governments can't tax and borrow enough to run concentration camps, to run giant global wars, to do all the horrible things that happened in the 20th century. They couldn't have done it without central banking. Central banking is a great, evil, monstrous institution. It's grown and it's grown and it's grown, and now maybe we're towards the end of it. I don't know.
You know, that's what they said in the beginning of this country. They were saying that, you know, one of the biggest evils that America has to defend itself against is central banks.
Well, that's true. And in fact, there has been a battle for central banking and against central banking throughout American history. The Jeffersonians were against it. The Hamiltonians for it. Thomas DiLorenzo, another great anarchist thinker and economist, a wonderful new book out on Hamilton and the evil of Hamiltonianism throughout American history. Also, he wrote two great books on Abe Lincoln. Look at Tom DiLorenzo's site on Mises.org, archive on Mises.org, and also on LouRockwell.com. Many, many great articles, great books. And, you know, this is, it is possible to change. We don't have to put up with it. And I think that they're worried about things. I hear that music, so we'll come back. I know, Ernie.
Well, you know, it's already the end of the first hour, man. We're done. We got Motorhome Diaries coming up. Thanks, Lou. It was great spending
Ernie, thank
time
you.
With you.
Take a look at LouRockwell.com. And
yes,
exciting,
we will.
There's exciting times.